On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
You're going to meet a visiting psychoanalyst, Phil Stokoe, who's here for this year's annual Freud Conference and is able to shed light on what's going on with the global trend towards populism. And you'll also meet a blind artist. I don't know how you can paint when you're blind. I'm astonished. But Erica will explain more to us. How wonderful. But her work goes across many different dimensions. That's what's coming up on today's Conversation Hour. My co-host is the word nerd, the cruciverbalist, the crossword setter and regular broadcaster here now at ABC Radio, David Astle, who's pretty much got this job down pat. Morning to you, David.
Good morning, John. This job, being this radio job, it's a lot of fun, and it's nice to be bouncing off the bench more regularly these days.
Should I trust you?
You have every reason to trust me, John. In fact, we are talking about psychopathy very shortly in this hour, so you can assess whether I actually would qualify as a psychopath. I don't think I do.
Did you see Pat Karvelas from Radio National sent me a thing during the week? It's on my phone. Just fill in time for a second. I'll read it to you.
Well, what about gender? Do you know the word gender or coich or nerpish or tamer? Now, these are words that are unique to Western Australia.
It's from a website called Radio Today. And its headline is Radio Presenters and Journalists Among the Top Jobs for Psychopaths. Oxford research psychologist Dr. Kevin Dutton has done the work. If you work in radio, you're more likely to be subject to psychopathic behaviour from your co-workers, according to the findings presented in a new book. He's from the Department of Experimental Psychology. He's written a book called The Wisdom of Psychopaths, and it details the jobs most likely to attract psychopaths.
I'm sure that there are the jobs that featured very prominently. It just so happens that those two you mentioned are those two roles that I fulfil.
Media presenters, police, surgeons, chefs, lawyers, and CEOs.
It's interesting. That's lawyers doesn't surprise me. And in fact, you're a radio broadcaster and a lawyer, John.
Tick.
Have you ever? You're a journalist too, really. Let's face it. Chasing stories.
I've never been trained or qualified in it, but I do it. Yes, that's true.
Do you cook at home?
Yes, sometimes. Not enough, according to Jan.
Do you aspire to being a CEO one day?
If you've got something to put to me, I'm happy to have a look at it.
So really, you're pretty much, aside from being a copper, which some would say that you already are, slicing and dicing.
Stitch them up.
That's right, the egos and sensibilities of your interviewees. Yeah, every working day.
Anyway, we sort of had a bit of a giggle about that, as you would.
As you would.
So you've been discovering some new words?
I have, and now all these words are unique to Western Australia. At least that's what was claimed by the Macquarie's Dictionary Word Map. And this is a chart, a lexical atlas of vernacular around Australia. The likes of potato fritters versus potato scallops versus all potato cakes. But I drilled down and found some very, very obscure ones. And I was over there last week for a week. Over the west.
Oh, the west.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
For a week in Perth.
What were you doing?
A thing called the Scribblers Festival, which is a new festival for kids. And it was a lot of fun all through the schools and big sort of open marquees in at Claremont. And we just had people all weekend and all week. With but one thing I wanted to test while I was over there was to put these colloquialisms in front of kids.
Do they have flip-flops, yandals or sandals or thongs?
I actually don't know. There is a strong...
Swimmers, bathers or... What's the other one? There's another one.
Oh, no, there's all sorts of... There's budgie smugglers.
Togs.
And, yes. Disgusters. Dick stickers.
Hang on. Can we wind back a bit?
Well, you brought it up, so to speak. Anyhow, all these words that I put in front of kids, it was incredible because they largely drew a blank. Coich, which is a word from the Noongar language, which is an axe.
And I thought that was a sort of egg-based Spanish type of frittata.
You see, this is what I was encouraging the kids. If you don't know the word, make it up. And of course, the made-up definitions were hilarious, and it was the highlight of one of the highlights of the trip.
So do you kind of do workshops with kids?
I do. Yeah, lots. We invent a word. That's one session I do. And I do word games and puzzles. We do mini crosswords. I do all sorts of, language sessions with kids.
So who books you for these? Because it wouldn't be the teachers, because you make the teachers look boring.
Well, in this case, it was the publisher. The festival got in touch with
the publisher. Teachers hate you.
No, they'd love me.
No, because you make their classes really dull in comparison. When they all go back to school, they say, well, that other guy was really good fun. Why are you so boring?
Yeah, but I tell you what, the best teachers get involved and the worst teachers sit at the back and check out their phones and they have an hour off while... the visiting Krusty the Clown does his word thing. But most schools, I'm glad to say, make the most of an author's visit. So you may be there in residence or you may do three or four sessions across a day. And, everyone's happy. Like it's a great day.
And are you wrung out by the end of the day? Because keeping that many kids, keeping them engaged, connected, it's exhausting.
It can be, and my heart goes out to teachers. I am a qualified teacher, and I know it is a very tough gig and probably a neglected role. That is one that we should pay more money to and pay more respect to, because it can be an exhausting job. It is an exhausting job. But also the key to running a good class or a good word session is you have the kids help with the load. And offer as much as you're giving them.
Look, I've got some text messages for you. Anne from Hawthorne wants help with 13 across.
today's is diabolical. Do not start learning how to do cryptic crosswords with today's crossword. Sorry. You're not getting it.
Oh, okay. That's tough. Tough love. And you have way too much empathy to be a psychopath, according to this text.
Mm-hmm.
That's very generous.
But maybe it's a semblance of empathy.
You think I'm feigning empathy?
Well, by name, that's all I'm saying. You do good empathy, John, I'll say that.
Oh, look, in 20 years, it's the first time I've done that.
Yeah, I have that effect on people.
So what else have you got coming up? There's something you're doing up in Albury Wodonga.
I am, and I'm looking forward to it very much. Winter Solstice, I'm hosting, in fact, for the sixth year running, a thing called the Winter Solstice. It's an awareness of youth suicide prevention and depression.
Now, remind us, there's a personal story behind the evolution of this annual event.
There is, and probably the organisers would be reluctant for me to go into detail, but two of the key organisers behind this event that started back in 2013, a few years prior to that, they lost their 15-year-old daughter to suicide. And they're close friends of mine, and we all felt impotent, profoundly impotent, and also felt resolved to try and make a difference, try and change the culture, try and change the conversation. So we put together this event back in 2013, and it's blossomed ever since. We've got Samuel Johnson, we've got Ian Roberts from the Rugby League. In the past, we've had Pat McGorry, we've had Tracy Spicer, we've had Archie Roach. It's just a big, open, free event happening in Albury on the 21st from sundown. But really what we're hoping is that more communities, more suburbs, more streets realise Winter Solstice is a time to have that conversation about people who are vulnerable and people who need to reach out, seek professional care, or just communicate and connect.
And this year's featured guest, astonishing.
Oh, it is. As I mentioned, Samuel Johnson, who has done...
I've got another one on the sheet of paper here. Les Murray.
Is the coup of the... I didn't want to blow Les's horn too loud and proud because...
What?
Look, Les is a spectacular coup for the event. And he... As many listeners would know, has suffered from depression for a long time.
Australia's foremost poet.
He is. He's prodigious and illustrious, but also Les, at the best of times, is not a keen traveller. And I didn't want to underscore the fact that he's coming in case that we disappoint people that he opts out. But he, at this stage, he has...
he's expected.
He's expected. But and we would be delighted to see him.
His health is... he's not a young man. His health will always be paramount. And if he does make it there, that'll be fabulous.
It will
if
be
he
fabulous.
Doesn't, well, Samuel Johnson, no slouch when it comes to telling a story, motivating a crowd and getting people pretty much on side.
No, it should be great. And, yeah, we really hope that this snowballs into something more national. And it certainly made a difference with more headspace clinics have been established across regional areas. And Greg Hunt's been very active in...
The Health Minister.
The Health Minister, putting funding towards suicide prevention. And so, look, good things are happening, but these things happen slowly.
And you should all give yourselves a big pat on the back. And that's itself an astonishing commitment to have made to get such a illustrious crowd along year after year. And to get the format down pat like this is amazing as well.
You seem to mention the word Pat a few times, and shout out to Pat, my mother-in-law, who does listen to this show. And she and I are going to Japan very soon. Looking
Have
forward
a great
to that
trip.
Very much, Pat.
David Astle is inviting you, if you're in the Albury-Wodonga area, to participate in the winter solstice for survivors of suicide and friends. It's hosted by David, who makes a personal commitment to see this through. David Astle is my co-host. I'm John Fain. Our first guest is here for this year's Freud Conference. It's on at the Melbourne Brain Centre at the University of Melbourne's Kenneth Meyer Building, and you can look up Freud Conference on your favourite Google if that's what you'd like to get in touch, the people you'd like to get in touch with or go along. Over here from the UK is Phil Stokoe. He's a psychoanalyst, organisational consultant, and a former clinical director of the Tavistock and Portman National Health Service Foundation Trust. Phil, welcome to Melbourne.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you here. And you're talking about populism, the rise of populism, almost spontaneously in countries right across the developed world. What do you think's going on?
It depends which way you look at it. You can either look at it starting from what's going on for the individual, or what I'm trying to do is to see how individuals get caught up through processes that are going on at a group level, at a societal level. And so if we start there, then the thing that I think has been the most powerful in part of the development is the neoliberal free market total commitment by all governments, which has created, in my view, massive inequality. And it's the inequality which is the cause of all of this. But it's done it because what the free market theory is that the individual continues to think rationally. And this is, in my view, nonsense. Individuals don't think rationally, particularly in groups.
Well, some do. Furious.
Well, the problem is that people like to think they do.
We try to in this room.
Well, yes, and all the time we are influenced by parts of us that we don't know about. And it's those parts that if we've never visited them and we haven't understood them, will then become hooks that allow us to get caught up in processes that are going on in a much bigger way. So, for example, the thing that is most powerful for all of us is anxiety, and the most primitive kind of anxiety is survival anxiety, life and death. Now, what you do is that you try to work with anxiety in a creative way, and that allows us to have rational thought. But if what we try to do is get rid of anxiety, and most of us do try and get rid of anxiety, then we are subject to anybody who comes along and creates anxiety and then offers us a solution to that anxiety.
Isn't a little bit of anxiety healthy?
It's absolutely healthy. In fact, it's the thing that shows that we're alive.
Yeah.
So I'm saying...
Drives you.
It's the driver. It's the thing that gives us energy. But it is curious that in human beings, we all try to avoid anxiety. It's the reason why Hollywood makes so much money out of horror films. So that we all know that the woman who goes into the dark house and doesn't switch on the lights is doing something really crazy. We feel anxious as we're watching this, and apparently she doesn't. And so her lack of anxiety makes her available to all of the horrible things that are about to happen to her. And my view is that in society, the anxiety that would be felt in different ways has become focused in one area, and the one area is money. So that everybody becomes anxious in a way that links to money. And then if you are somebody who has no money, that puts you in a particularly difficult position. But equally, if you're somebody who has loads of money, you become anxious that you're going to lose that money. So the one thing that links everybody is the anxiety about money, and that's created by removing all of the financial regulations, which is what the free market did, to leave the only thing that matters, wealth.
One of the lines that caught my eye, and there are many lines your paper about the impact of power on the mind of the politician, was the line that the leaders have the misfortune of winning. The line is the bad luck of winning. What did you mean by that?
Well, this is the other way of thinking about how we get caught up. So if you end up winning, you end up in a position where you have to maintain your authority. And the trouble with that is that you're also dependent on those people who give you authority, which means that you are liable to be manipulated by the projections into you. So, I mean, just to take a different kind of example, the example that happens all the time, day to day, in healthcare. So a patient arrives, and the patient is terrified that they're going to die, and the nurse, who's the first person to meet them, has to acknowledge that and take that and work with it. Now, nurses are trained to know that they're going to be made to feel anxious in that kind of a way, so they can process it and they can absorb it and they can contain the anxiety. And so the patient becomes dependent, the nurse takes over the anxiety and helps them and is able to think about what the problem is.
It's like an emotional transaction.
Yeah, it is an emotional transaction. And in psychoanalysis, we call it projective identification. The politician is in a similar position, and the politician has given up the idea that there could be all kinds of ways of dealing with whatever the problem is in exchange for a feeling of authority and power. And the problem with that is that when you are filled with the anxiety projected into you by the populace, your ability to think is very, very restricted. And that's why it's a terrible thing to have won the election.
You become a hostage, essentially.
You become a hostage to your own propaganda and to your own belief that you should have all of the answers. And the thing about answers is that answers require question, and question requires being able to be curious. And the one thing that is absolutely clear is that when you're in a state of mind where you are trying to manage anxiety instead of being able to be open to it, the one thing you're not looking for is not knowing. You're looking for certainty.
You lose your curiosity.
You lose curiosity, and curiosity loss is the thing that causes the biggest problems.
Back where your home is in the UK at the moment, you're dealing with Brexit and all the repercussions of that. But we can go across to continental Europe. We can go across to the old Iron Curtain Eastern European states. We can have a look at what's going on in North America. We can have a look at what's going on in all sorts of parts of the world. And you get this populism regardless of economic anxiety, in my view. But the common element I see everywhere is a blowback against large movements of people. Mass migration and the flow of, in particular, not just refugees, who most people feel some sympathy towards, even if they're uncomfortable with huge numbers, but the huge numbers of people who are and never will be refugees, but in particular in Europe, are trying to simply find a better life. I see the direct link between the flows of people and the rise of populism. It's a reaction to that.
Well, yeah.
And there's a subliminal racism to much of it.
The subliminal racism, I think, is explained rather well by a colleague of mine called Thackeray Davids, who talks about the unconscious racism that is part of our development and probably served us when we were just becoming human beings, organizing us into family groups and making us frightened of a threat from
outside. Stranger danger.
The stranger danger, exactly.
Mexicans are rapists. We have to build a wall.
Well, all of that stuff, it seems to me, is linking to this primitive belief system. And the thing that I didn't talk about earlier on is that in the face of anxiety and the push towards certainty, which comes when you feel anxious, you want a certain answer, you want an immediate black and white kind of answer, these things link to very primitive parts of us where it is just black and white. And so the unconscious racism in us is one of those beliefs that can then organize a sense of security. The security comes with the certainty. The certainty is, I am threatened by this stranger. And that then makes me feel that I know now why it is that I feel so anxious.
There's too many of them. They're coming, and this is universal. They're coming over here and taking over. And that's whether you're talking about Poland, Hungary, Romania, England, France, Germany, Australia. We talk about that, well, not all of us, but lots of people say, oh, there's too many Chinese coming and buying everything. And on it goes. In the United States, the same has happened. Donald Trump's audiences at his rallies were 90% white and old.
Yes. Absolutely, and the Brexit vote was a similar kind of demography. The point about it, the point that I'm making, is that the absence, in the face of certainty, the absence of curiosity is the thing that is most dangerous. In 2016, when the referendum was going on, the LSE produced a startlingly brilliant paper about immigration. The reason it was startlingly brilliant was that it was readable. And it was readable by anybody, and it had an 8-point summary, which essentially, based on the evidence which the rest of the paper produced, but essentially it said immigration, all of the myths about immigration are lies, they're wrong. For example, that it costs money to the country that immigrants come in is wrong. What happens is very clearly that immigrants create wealth. So that there isn't a loss of jobs.
But you can put the London School of Economics and their, in a post-truth world, the facts and the figures simply are irrelevant. It's all about emotion.
That's the point I was going to make, exactly that point, that there it was, a very simple-to-read piece of information that could have been used and wasn't used by anybody.
No, it's no use. It was not by anybody.
Because it requires curiosity and interest. The advantage of creating a panic about immigration, about being taken over. In my talk, I have a slide, a video that comes on. I shouldn't be saying this because it's supposed to be a surprise to the people listening.
Surprise!
Of zombies, the zombie attack. Yeah. Why is it that there are so many zombie films? Because it speaks to this part of us, the fear of being taken over. And it's not rational. The point that I'm making is that the only solution to populism is to create curiosity and interest again.
Tell me, Phil, I'm curious about, I mean, John mentioned in passing this new phrase, that sinister phrase, post-truth world.
Yeah.
The scenario that you've described of the new sort of political landscape also seems to be a post-ethical world. Has ethics been lost? Have we lost sight of what is the right thing to do, the moral thing to do?
As soon as you're in the world of certainty, there isn't any kind of ethic or moral. There is only extreme good and extreme bad. When you study the development of the mind, there is a stage shortly after birth that the infant creates, and it does so because at the very beginning of life, all feelings are enormous. There is no internal defensive structure. And as a result, the infant has to manage that and does so by projecting feelings into the outside world and feeling that they are attacking from the outside world. And then there are the other kind of feelings, which are yummy, yummy feelings, which the infant... And that's Freud's pleasure principle. But it creates a universe, and the universe is a fascinating universe. It's what I call the fundamentalist state of mind, although the person who first described it called it the paranoid schizoid position, which is... rather complex.
Problematic.
Yeah, but the world is
good
this.
Good in Scrabble, though.
Great for Scrabble.
Yeah.
This is a world that is ruled by the ideal, so you're either ideal or you're shit. There are only two places to be. And that means that the language of that world is the language of blame, because if you're not ideal, somebody's to blame for it. So that's the only language you've got available.
It's very familiar.
Trope,
isn't it?
And as you go on exploring this world, it becomes more and more familiar. So that there are only two kinds of relationship, for example. I either merge with you, in which case we are all together, and he isn't. He's the other.
It's interesting.
Exactly.
Quite right.
Or because he is different, then the other kind of relationship is sadomasochist. You have to attack and fight. Those are the only two kinds of relationships available in that state of mind. And that means that difference, and this goes back to the point that you were making about immigration, in this state of mind, difference is a threat because it immediately raises the question, which one of us is the ideal? And so it becomes an absolute life and death issue about which is going to be the ideal and which isn't, and you feel threatened. You're looking as if you want to stop me.
No, no, because to understand the problem is one thing, but to turn the problem around is another. Sure. To understand an apple, you have to actually eat it, but what do you do after that? So what do we do now with all this? If we have these insights, if we have these understandings, how do we overcome the problems that populism is creating?
Well, the first thing you do is that you recognise that although people get caught in these positions of certainty, these individuals, when you talk to them individually, are capable of adult functioning. So that you begin, weirdly, the rest of me is totally pessimistic, but in terms of the politics, I weirdly feel optimistic. I think that my experience of working, for example, with borderline personality disorder patients is that these are people who can only live in that kind of black and white world. It's a terrifying world to live in. And it is possible, gradually, by allowing the question to be raised in their mind about how it is that you are different, how it is that you're coping and yet are not a threat. Just raising that question creates curiosity again. And in my view, curiosity is one of the three drives of our mental development, and it's the one that gets suppressed.
Okay, but we've got an increasingly fragmented world, and the great paradox is that we have more information available to us than any generation in the history of human civilization, but we are selecting less and less of it and reinforcing constantly our worldview rather than challenging it.
This is true.
So we're getting dumber while we're getting smarter.
Yeah.
So what do we do about that?
Again, I fall back on what you've just done, what you've just done to me, which is to ask a question. Now, either I, hearing your question, feel threatened by your question, in which case I will come.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not. I'm interested in your
question. He's in the business.
I hold on to the possibility of being interested in this question. And so in doing so, there is an opportunity for new ideas to emerge.
Yeah, the contest of ideas.
Exactly. Hmm. And that's the principle of creativity. And it seems to me that there's always a danger. It's the danger that science warns about. It says, as a scientist, what you have to do is not to try to prove your own hypothesis, but to test it, to challenge it. And I think
and
that...
And to be prepared to be wrong.
And to be prepared to be wrong as a consequence.
And to be shown to be wrong.
And to delight in being wrong, because you've learned something from it.
Because being wrong is part of being right.
Being wrong is part of being creative. It's not part of being right. I don't like that word right, because right is moving back to right and wrong again.
Okay.
It is very difficult. I mean, when you are talking to an adolescent, say, I mean, I heard you were talking about suicide earlier on, and when you're talking to an adolescent, it very often, I started working with adolescents. Adolescents, I love working with adolescents, but adolescents have this problem, which is that they live in bodies that look more or less adult. And they have learned to speak in a way that sounds more or less rational and sensible. And so you can get an adolescent telling you about how other adolescents are allowed to stay out until past midnight. And what you fall into is the trap of thinking that you're having a rational conversation. Actually, what you are doing is you are back with the baby who's going...
A cauldron of hormones.
Exactly.
Yes.
And so you just need to be able to step away from that.
Phil Stokoe, the psychoanalyst and organisational consultant, has been our first guest. Continuing with the flirtation with science. Professor Jamie Rossjohn and Dr. Erica Tandoori have wandered into my studio. They're inviting people to feel, to touch, to learn science in ways no one's ever done before, particularly, though, for people who are low vision or even blind, to help them to understand science. Jamie Rossjohn, good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Erica, thank you very much for coming in as well.
Thank you, John.
And we'll get your story in just a second. Jamie, what's the point of doing what you're doing, sensory exploration of science?
Well, why not? I view the low vision community as a very well regarded and important member of society, and I wanted to reach out to a community that ordinarily scientists may not reach out to. I view the light microscope as being a fascinating discovery that's revolutionised the life sciences over the last couple of hundred centuries, but it's an item of equipment that's inaccessible to those of low vision, so I want to bring the light microscope to the low vision and the blind community.
All right, so this brings Erica very much into our focus.
It does.
That's something, Erica, you do struggle with. Explain to us, first of all, about your low vision.
So it's juvenile macular degeneration. It started when I was about 23. I noticed the symptoms, and it was my first... I was just beginning art school at the VCA, so just a stone's throw from here. And
what did you notice?
I will never forget that day. It was over the summer, and I was in a rental home in Carlton, and I remember it was a blue counter, and there was a white crumb on the counter, and every time I looked at the crumb, it would disappear, and I'd look away and it would pop back into view. I thought, this is something so strange. So I went to the doctor, and then I had tests, and over the summer I waited to see the specialist, and then I was told I had a genetic, you know, inherited disorder. I had no idea that this thing ran in my family.
Did your family know?
No, and that's the thing. As immigrants, you also lose your history. You lose, you know, coming from Europe, who was to know? You know, the decimation of war, movement of people. You lose a medical history amongst so many other things. So I had no idea.
When I was living in shared houses in the inner city at university, there were crumbs on
the
counter.
Yes, there were plenty. Oh, yeah.
And indeed, they were green half the time.
Green by then, yeah.
But tell me, Erica, you're a visual artist, and you were studying visual art at the VCA.
Yeah.
And suddenly these crumbs were becoming more and more present on your sight. How did you respond as a student and as an aspiring artist?
Oh, my God. I had just finished a philosophy degree at Melbourne Uni. And bear in mind, in my early, you know, my upbringing, my father had an art gallery and a shop in High Street, Armidale. So I'd just been immersed in the art world. And I could always, for some reason, genetically I was given the ability to draw and paint. But I was also given this hidden, inherited blindness that I didn't know about until I'd already been painting and selling work, you know, from a young age. That was it. My father said, you're going to be a portrait artist, you know, blah, blah, blah. I was painting and selling from 11 or 12. It was, you know.
Just a natural path
for
you.
It was just a natural thing that, you know, we had Norman Lindsay's in the shop. We had Tom Roberts. We had beautiful art. I spent my youth looking at art books and reading and writing and painting, and anyway, blah blah blah. I thought I'd become a journalist, so when I finished school I went to journalism, and then I went to Melbourne Uni, and I thought, you know what, I'll go back to art school. And it happened over that summer.
So how much vision do you have now?
So I can't see you at all, John. So what happens is, contrary to what people think, with central vision loss it's not a black spot, it's an area of absence. And the brain fills in that absence with all sorts of things. So I can't see your head from here. I see what I think might be a pink shirt, but your head is red. It's like the receptive fields take in the environment around it. So I can see the red in the background, you know, in the studio.
You have some peripheral vision?
I have blurry peripheral. Now, everyone's vision is blurry in the periphery.
Sure.
So when that central acuity is taken away, everyone's visually blind.
So how do you paint?
Well, it's with great difficulty, very close to the canvas, you know, with my note, and just, I have to have good light. And you know what? I don't know. And you know what? Art is in the imagination. It's not in the retina.
Okay. And the whole Bionic Eye program is telling us that as well. So let's get back to science. So,
yes.
Jamie, you're working with Erica.
Yes.
To what objective?
I just want to bring the excitement of infection and immunity research at Monash to the low vision community. Why shouldn't they hear about the latest scientific discoveries? Why should we marginalise them? Why can't we inspire children to pursue a career in science? And I was very fortunate to come across Erica Seavey because, unlike Erica, I don't have an artistic bone in my body. and so we've got somebody who can expertly guide us in this exhibition. It is an exhibition that I have a degree of anxiety about.
Well, that's a good thing, apparently.
It is a good thing.
I've got a lot of anxiety about it, too, I can assure
but
you.
But I'm excited by it,
yeah.
And I think we'll put our best foot forward on May the 31st.
So one of the things Phil's just been reassuring us about,
yeah,
is that by challenging unleashing our creative,
yep,
juices and working interdisciplinary,
yep,
on a problem,
yes,
like this is probably one way to do that, we might actually find out stuff that we otherwise,
yes,
didn't know. So might it be, we know that people compensate. If you lose one sense, you tend to have a much heightened other sense.
Mm-hmm.
Might we find we actually improve our understanding of complex science by talking to people who have lost one of their senses and are therefore thinking
we
in a
might.
Different way.
Maybe we find the essence of things. So, you know, creating things in a tactile way, something like this dendritic cell that I'm holding up.
Which looks like a scrunched up, what would we say, tea towel?
I think it looks more like a pine cone.
Yeah, pine cone.
It's got these fronds.
Mm-hmm. Polymorphic.
So, the thing that really strikes me about this exhibition is that, and we talk about the electron microscope, everyone is blind before this knowledge. No one can see these things without technologies.
Mm-hmm.
So, in a way, you know, we're all equal in front of this knowledge. And with technology and then with art, we articulate these concepts and we bring them to the fore so that we can all see and participate in this amazing knowledge.
I thought that was a giant garlic. What is that in your other hand, Erica?
It does look like a giant garlic.
She's brought in some toys.
I brought in some toys that I made. So this is a macrophage, or my impression of a macrophage. So
what's a macrophage?
It's one of the immune... Type of an immune cell.
So this is your artistic rendition it looks like a frond of garlic that's got many different bits,
yeah,
hanging,
so
off
it's,
it.
Yeah, so it's clay and it's
the hipster
got
garlic.
These, yeah, hipster garlic, exactly. But it doesn't smell.
It's got dreads.
Yeah, it's got dreads, yeah. It's caught bacteria in its tendrils, so it's made with fibre and clay. It's very organically made.
I've got a question actually for Jamie.
Yeah.
Getting Erica on board to help,
yeah,
with the making things more tactile, what have you learnt in this process,
mm,
as a scientist?
I think it's the power of outreach activities,
mm,
how you're breaking down barriers. I'm very keen on building stronger links between universities and the societies in which we find ourselves in, and by doing so,
we'll break down the ivory tower.
But what about macrophages, and what about the actual your discipline itself? Have you actually learnt by having to translate almost the world to Erica so she could manifest it in as art?
Well, yeah, to see your scientific research being turned into objects of art, which, mm, I hadn't really dreamt of before, is actually very rewarding. I think making Lego models out of immune molecules so that children and adults can learn about immune recognition, immune, mm, escape. We've got a team of lab heads at Monash BDI who are really on board on this exhibition, about 10 different lab heads, about the importance of vaccination, antimicrobial, mm-hmm, resistance. So it's a real powerhouse of scientific education that I'm really excited about.
The thought that I was having was about emotion.
Mm.
Freud was the first person I don't know whether he was the first person, but he articulated the way that we experience the world is emotionally.
Mm.
And then that allows for the development of thinking and finally of rational thinking, which of course is the one that we all think we do all the time and mostly don't. And I'm just thinking about what happened outside the studio, which is that I was given some of these pieces of art and to feel, and I was given a cell to touch that had been infected, and it had a huge impact on me because for the first time I really got something about how awful and powerful an infection is, because here was a cell and I could feel that most of it had this horrible lumpy stuff in it. Now that was a much more powerful way of understanding something about infection and the danger of infection than anything a scientist would say.
What if it was sleek and smooth? If you'd represented infection with something velvety?
Well,
doing all that too. I'm using different ways to articulate dramatic processes. And I think the emotional thing really got me. The other day, I'm making a huge display of cytotoxic T cells, so they're the killer T cells, and they're huge. So I'm making two of them. They're almost the size of soccer balls on this big black board, and their tendrils are out, and they're attacking this huge ball of red cancer, which I've covered in spiral pasta and painted it glossy red. So I'm making these really articulate sort of dynamic things. And I was laughing. I'm in the kitchen laughing at these things that I've made because they're like little creatures.
Mm.
But then it became so profound because this is the story of life, eons of life, the original arms race that I'd suddenly created in front of me. That was just, it was so emotionally powerful. My sister died of a brain tumour just a few years ago. She succumbed to cancer. We all have these stories. The work that Jamie and his colleagues do, the work that scientists do in the fight against disease, we're going to have fun next week. It's going to be amazing. But there's something really, really profound going on as well.
So how do you get your head around the complexity of the science in order to represent?
I don't want to get my head around it. I want to be immersed and just...
Eric has been embedded in the laboratory for the last 2 months, soaking up the work that we do, speaking with other scientists, and so she can then conceptualise some of the science that we've been doing.
Yeah.
She's a lot more, as I said, artistic
I'm
than
really
I will ever be. And
about
so, and she's a real dynamo, real pleasure to have in the lab. And as I said, I'm anxious but very excited by the prospects on Thursday, and looking forward to seeing the emotion flowing from the participants.
So what's happening here is that the Freud Conference and also your exhibition and Discovery Day and Biomedicine, about which we'll give people the details in a moment, you're kind of both doing something similar in your respective fields, one inside our head and the other inside the rest of the torso. You're asking us, first of all, to take a leap into the unknown and to trust people who have learned something that the rest of us don't know.
Or let's explore together.
But and you're illuminating. That's the other thing too.
Yeah.
I think the illumination thing is important because Erica, in her website, talks about the difference between seeing and vision.
Mm.
And we're talking here, I think, about bringing vision to the various arenas that we're working in.
Mm.
But vision is about, and I'm interested in why, John, you asked, suppose it was velvety, because that was your reaction to a description I was making, and I have no idea what I would have felt if it was velvety. But I'll tell you the thing that hit me was that the amount that was going on in this cell that was nothing to do with the cell. So whether it was velvety or hard, it was still shocking, the amount. Now that is about creating a vision rather than having an image and seeing in a very sort of straightforward way. And I think that the development that Jamie and Erica are doing together is about bringing out of what has been seen with your microscope a vision of something that we can all understand and react to.
Sure,
and we react to it emotionally, like you did, with saying, what about it was velvet?
Yeah, but what is it about velvet, John?
Yeah.
Just lie down and tell us if you can.
Jamie, the germs are always presented to us as if they're red and angry and nasty, but in fact I remember looking down a microscope as a kid and seeing something that I thought was absolutely like a coral landscape. It was fascinating. It was vivid. It was rich. It was, in some ways, it was beautiful rather than frightening.
Absolutely. Science is beautiful, and we've got three-dimensional models of viruses that the low vision community can feel, and then we'll be talking about how the immune system can recognise those.
But you can have something that's fatal but beautiful.
Yeah, absolutely.
You can, but I've noticed with viruses as opposed to the immune cells, so our superheroes, they look different. The viruses look spiky, and they intrinsically and innately they look scary.
Aren't we anthropomorphising the germs?
That's what I'm doing,
Exactly what we're doing.
We're giving human characteristics
to
tiny, tiny little microbes.
But this will be very much a learning process as well. I don't think we'll get it absolutely right the first time, but I'll be working closely with the Australian Research Council to make sure this exhibition isn't an isolated event, and we'll be
You should get Pixar on board too. I'm thinking if the emotions can be, you know, embodied into characters, then why not infections and germs and the T cells as well, the good guys.
Yeah.
Well, you're doing it with tactile 3D objects for the visually impaired and blind people.
Yeah.
But the same is done through animation, and scientific animation now is a huge part of communicating science.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, kids go to art school, they learn cartooning skills and then go and work in a lab.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
And Melbourne is a centre of medical research. We've got heaps of that going on.
Did you ever learn touch typing, Erica? I've got to ask.
Oh, no, God, no. Look.
You should explain that. That was the advice that you got from someone at the college, was it not?
Yeah. No, it was actually the medical specialist, the diagnosis.
On that diagnosis, to forget about art and do touch typing.
Yeah.
You've completely blown that advice out of the water by...
Yeah, I have. I still can't touch type. I should. Mm. Be great. Be a really good... thing to do.
Lots of germs and infections on keyboards, I understand.
Well, you've got voice recognition now. None of us need to.
Yeah,
learn how
I don't need to. I did my whole PhD just dictating to the computer or getting articles read to me on the computer.
You did?
Yeah.
And Eric's enthusiasm, excuse the pun, has infected the lab.
The Sensory Scientific Exhibition and Discovery Day at Monash Biomedicine Discovery Institute. Erica Tandori is the artist in residence. Thank you so much.
It's been fascinating.
And Professor Jamie Rossjohn is the head of infection and immunity programs at Monash University and a distinguished researcher in his own right. The Freud Conference is on at the University of Melbourne. Phil Stokoe has been our guest telling us about that. Have a lovely visit to Melbourne.
Thank you.
Stay longer next time. And David Astle is inviting you to the Albury-Wodonga Winter Solstice. Thank you for coming. On your ABC, this has been The Conversation Hour.